The Swahili enclave formed an encampment all its own within the greater camp. When the host set stake across rolling or broken pasture, the witch's tents always tattooed the hazy vista, an oval of shining ochre among the jumbled phalanxes of canvas. The Scions had sat and pondered this sight more than a few evenings, like every other company in the army. Karampa, in particular, was given to dreaming aloud. The granary, he called it. Here his little brother was starving, and yet the granary remained closed. Several times he had leapt to his feet to display the hook, lifting his skirts, crying out for food to feed his little brother. And though everyone about Zaranga's hearth laughed with crazed merriment, they also became exceedingly reluctant to encourage the Kingulati prince. Karampa was far too fond of his little brother. It was also the reason why none of the witches strayed from their enclave, save Anna Sarimba Sirwa. As the days piled into months, as the memories of wives and lovers became more and more elusive, the famed Swahili witches, the nuns, became a kind of narcotic. More than a few little brothers had been throttled for mere glimpse or rumor. At first Sorwheel had no clue as to why he stalked the camp searching for the granary. He had lain on his cot for watches, pinned by exhaustion unlike any he had known, one that made slop of his center, as if he were naught but a head and limbs, suture to a heap of entrails. He had stared at the canvas ceiling, glimpsing portents and water stains, feeling the prickle of Porsparian's continuous absence. And then he was up, answering to a restlessness he could not quite feel. And he was walking. Initially he decided he sought out the Swahili because he needed to thank Anna Sarimba Sirwa for saving him. But this rationale, for all its convenience, did not long survive its insincerity. The unkind fact was that Sorwheel felt no gratitude. Of the many Three Seas peculiarities that Zaranga called out for disgust and ridicule, none occasioned quite the same cutting vehemence as the witches. The successor prince thought them worse than whores, and certainly more accursed. "They make pits of their mouths," he said once, referring to the Tusks' ancient condemnation of prostitutes. But Sirwa's lack of gratitude had nothing to do with grudges against licentious women. Since the Sakarpai considered all sorcery anathema, the Swahili struck him little as more than a wicked anomaly. Yet one more Three Seas perversion. No, he felt no gratitude because he no longer considered his life a gift. Stars fog the vault of heaven in light. Clouds, like wisps of tugged wool, form the illusion of a surface, so that looking up seemed like gazing into waters of consummate clarity, an ocean of diamond emptiness. The ways of the camp were all but abandoned. Were it not for the odd voices and moans of the ailing, he would have thought it emptied of men. Maybe it was a combination of quiet and cool air, or maybe it was the stench that soaked the edges of his every breath. But the place seemed ancient and haunted, and the shadows seemed to boil with unseen threats. He found the granary more by chance than by unerring sense of direction. He slowed to a wary saunter when the sagging pyramids of its roofs rose into view. The tents were of the Einani parasol variety, with a single pole hoisting a square frame that formed the tasseled edges of the roof. They were pitched one against the other, with their entrances turned inward, so that their felt backs walled in the enclave. He had heard the tale of some Galeoff fool burning his fingers to stubs, trying to slit a peephole through one of the greased panels. But who knew whether this rumor were true, or something calculated precisely to prevent Galeoff fools from cutting peepholes? The Grand Mistress of the Swahili was an Anna Sarimba, after all. He followed the enclave's outer circuit, his ears pricked to voices he could not hear, his arm hairs tingling with the anxious expectation of sorcery. In his soul's eye, he saw the witches hanging above the oceanic heave of the horde. For his life, he could not think of what to do next. Twin torches on poles illuminated the entrance, drawing shags of ochre from the otherwise blue tent walls. Two heavenly-armored men stood between them, speaking in voices as muted as the torchlight was dim. They fell silent the instant they spied him. They were both clean-shaven, Nancer traditionalists, but the insignia stamped into the plates of their hauberks were unfamiliar to him. No surprise there. The question was whether they would recognize him. "I have come to see Anna Sarimba Serwa," he blurted in answer to their scowling gaze. The two regarded him for a torchlit heartbeat. The taller one smiled, an expression rendered malicious for the play of shadow across his hard face. He stepped aside, saying, "She told us you might come." The guardsman led him into the granary with the same uncanny focus, the same thoughtless discipline that seemed to characterize so many men of the ordeal. No fatuous words, no posturing or bored bullying. A Sakarpai guard would have bickered until either cowed by threats or bribed. The granary's courtyard was as dusty and trampled as any other ground in the camp, and with few exceptions, the surrounding tents were every bit as dark. Several censers had been set across the expanse, their smoky issue barely visible in the starlight. He breathed deep the odor, a pungent astringent of some kind, one specifically concocted to nullify the stench rising from the rotting miles surrounding them, or so he imagined. The tall Nancer man led him to a parasol tent on the far side of the oval courtyard, one identical to the others, save that it had been physically stitched to the tents adjoining. The entrance flap had been negligently drawn, revealing a golden sickle of interior light. Sorwheel's breath and ligaments tightened with every nearing step, as if he were a bow slowly drawn. The slit in the tent bobbed in his vision with erotic intensity, as though a candle had been lit beneath a courtesan's skirts, and he were about to glimpse the regions between her knees. Perhaps he had come to feed his little brother after all. "Wear her, my king," Aeschylus had said that fateful day in the umbilicus. "She walks with the gods." The Swayali guardsman bid him pause with a polite gesture, then fell to his knees and called softly into the opening. Sorwheel glimpsed ornate carpets and the odd leg of furnishing, nothing more. If anyone replied, he did not hear it. The guardsman simply stood and drew aside the ornately embroidered flap. "Kneel," he hissed as Sorwheel strode into the lane of light. Ignoring him, the Sarkarpai king ducked into the interior and stood blinking in the light. Three bronze lanterns hung from a three-armed bracket set high on the center pole, all of them dark. He had once asked Aeschylus why he bothered with lanterns when he could spark brighter lights with mere words. "Because lanterns burn whether I remember them or not," he had said. "Think of the way trivia weighs against your heart." Anna Sarimba Serwa apparently did not mind the burden of sorcerous illumination. A point of blinding white hung in the corner, twinkling like a pilfered star. Its brilliance revealed faint patterns of russet in the felt walls, sigils or plant motifs, and rendered the room's furnishings stark with shadow. Stacked chests, a cot much the same as his own, save for the luxury of the blankets and pillows heaped across it, a work table with canvas camp chairs. His boots felt an insult to the carpets beneath him, ranging landscapes wrought in black and silver, stylized according to exotic sensibilities. An unfamiliar perfume hung in the air. The Grand Mistress sat hunched over the work table, wearing naught but a silken shift, her sleeping garb, Sorwheel imagined. She hung her head to one side as she read, so that her hair fell in lazy blonde wings across her right shoulder. She had hooked her bare feet about the forward legs of the chair, an undignified pose, and all the more erotic for it. Silk hung loose about her breasts, and pulled tight across her parted thighs. The hairlessness of her legs made her seem a little girl, and so poisoned his desire with a peculiar shame. Sin. Everything three sees, no matter how awe-inspiring or beautiful, had to be greased in sin. "My brother finds you odd," she said, apparently still absorbed by the inked lines before her. "I find your brother odd. This occasioned a small smile, as well as her attention. She turned to regard him, careless enough with her knees to make him forget how to breathe. He struggled to remind himself that for all her wanton youth, she was the most powerful woman in all of Iarwa, short of her Empress Mother, who had been a whore.
"Have you come to thank me, or have you come to woo?"
Sekarpi King scowled.
"To thank you."
Her eyes ranged across him with a boldness that would have seen a Sekarpi wife or daughter whipped.
"That pouch hanging from your hip, where did you find that?"
He swallowed, at last understanding the reason for his otherwise inexplicable visitation.
"It's an heirloom, as ancient as my family."
She nodded, as if believing him.
"That motif, the triple crescent.
What about it?" he asked, far too aware of the proximity of her gaze to his groin. At last her eyes climbed to meet his own. Her look was cool, remote in the way of old and prideful widows. "That is the far antique mark of my family, the Anna Sarimba of Trisi." Sorwheel struggled to speak around memories of the goddess reaching into the muck of her womb.
"Would you like it back?"
A laugh like a sneezing cat.
"You seem more insolent than thankful."
And in a heartbeat, Sorwheel understood how the penetration of the Anna Sarimba, their godlike cunning, was much their greatest weakness as their greatest strength. Men, Saranga had said, were like children to them. Who fears children?
"I apologize," he said. "The past weeks have been difficult. This afternoon I murdered my slave in your father's name."
He saw Porsperian slump from the upright spear, hang twitching.
"You loved him," she observed with something resembling pity. He saw the light of watching fade from the slave's yellow eyes. "Here," Sorwheel said, grasping the pouch. "Take it as a gift."
"You are mad," a voice whispered in some corner of his soul.
"I would rather you keep it," she replied, with a frown almost identical to her brother's. "I'm not sure I like you, Horse King."
Sorwheel nodded as if in apology.
"Then I shall woo you," he said, turning to step back out into the cool Istuli night.
He half hoped that she would call him back, but was not surprised when she did not. He crossed the incense-fogged expanse of the granary, his thoughts roiling in that strange, fingerless way that prevents them from gripping your expression. He walked the way a man who had just gambled his freedom might walk, with the nimble gait of those preparing to run. Anna Sarimba Sirwa, she was one of the few, among the greatest to practice the arcane arts, were the rumors to be believed.
"What the mother gives!"
He had carried a koray, concealed within an arm's span of her embrace.
"You must take!"
The following weeks did not much pass like a dream as they seemed like one in hindsight. Despite Anna Sarimba Kayotis's fine words the day following the Battle of the Horde, he did not so much as consult with Sorwheel once when it came to the Shrank, let alone the mountain of trivial issues that confronted any great host on the march. Sorwheel and Zaranga spent most of their time mooning about the perimeter of the Prince Imperial's entourage, waiting to be called into whatever the ongoing debate. They were accorded the honor of martial advisors, but in reality, they were little more than messengers, runners. This fact seemed to weigh more heavily on Zaranga than Sorwheel, who would have been a runner for his father eventually, had the past months never happened. The successor prince sometimes spent entire watches cursing the lot while they supped together. The Zayumi Courts, Sorwheel had come to realize, was a kind of arena, a place where the nobility were inclined to count slights and nurture grudges, and where politicking through the dispensation of privileges had been raised to a lethal form of art. Zaranga did not so much despise the actual work of bearing missives. Sorwheel himself generally savored the freedom of riding through and about seas of trudging men. What he could not abide, Sorwheel decided, was the future, the fact that, when he finally found his way back to Domnyat, he would be forced to describe things his countrymen could not but see as indignities.
That in the sly calms between official discourse, they might murmur, "Zarunga the runner," to one another and laugh. More and more, Sorwheel saw fractions of his former self in the Zaomi prince. Glimpses of Sorwheel the orphan, Sorwheel the mourner. Zarunga had learned a dismaying truth about himself in fleeing when Sorwheel had turned to save Escalese. He had also lost his entire entourage, his brace, as the Zaomi called their boonsmen, as well as his beloved Obutegwa. For all his worldly manner, the successor prince had never experienced loss in his privileged life. Now he was stranded, as Sorwheel had been stranded, in the host of his enemy. And now he was burdened, as Sorwheel had been burdened, with questions of his own worth and honor. They did not so much speak of these things as act around them, the way young men are prone to do, with only brotherly looks and warm-handed teasing for proof of understanding. Zarunga still asked him about the goddess from time to time, his manner too eager for Sorwheel's comfort. The Sarkarpai king would simply shrug and say something about waiting for signs, or make some weak joke about Zarunga petitioning his dead relatives. The toll Zarunga had paid in self-respect had turned the man's wary hope into a kind of pressing need. Where before he had feared for his friend's predicament, now he wanted Sorwheel to be the instrument of the goddess, even needed him to be. Each day seemed to add a granule of spite to the hatred he was slowly accumulating in his soul. He even began to take risks in Coyotus's distracted presence, insolent looks, snide remarks, trifles that seemed to embolden him as much as they alarmed Sorwheel.
"Pray to her," Zarunga began to urge. "Mold faces in the earth."
Sorwheel could only look at him in horror, insist that he was trying to no avail, fretting all the while about the traces of his own intent the Ennis-Rimba might glimpse in the man's face. He had to be careful, exceedingly careful. He knew full well the power and cunning of the Aspect Emperor, having lost his father, his city, and his dignity to him. He knew far better than Zarunga. This was why, when he finally mustered the courage to ask his friend about the Nindari, those chosen by the gods to kill, he did so in the guise of passing boredom. "They are the most feared assassins in the world," the successor prince replied. "Men for whom murder is prayer. Fairly all the cults have them. And they say a Jokli has no devotees save Narindari." "But what use would the gods have of assassins when they need only deliver calumny and disaster?" Zarunga frowned as if at uncertain memories. "Why do the gods require devotion? Sacrifice? Lives are easy to take, but souls? Souls must be given." This was how Sorwheel came to think of himself as a kind of divine thief.
"What the mother gives, you must take."
The problem was that in the passage of days he felt nothing of this divinity. He ached and he hungered. He scratched his buttocks and throttled his little brother. He squatted as others squatted, holding his breath against the reek of the latrines, and he continually doubted. Primarily because what divinity he witnessed belonged to the Ennis-Rimba. As before, Coyotus remained a lodestone for his gaze. But where Sorwheel had peered after his horse and circumflex standard across the massing of faraway columns, now he could watch him from a distance of several spans. He was, Sorwheel came to realize, a consummate commander, orchestrating the activities of numberless thousands with mere words and manner. Requests and appraisals would arrive, and responses and reprimands would be dispatched. Failures would be scrutinized, alternatives considered. Successes would be ruthlessly exploited. Of course, none of these things carried the stamp of divinity, not in and of themselves or in their sum. No, it was the effortlessness of the Prince Imperial's orchestration that came to seem miraculous. The equanimity, the repose, and the ruthless efficacy of the man in the course of making a thousand mortal decisions. It was not, Sorwheel eventually decided, quite human. It was Dunyane. And there was the miracle of the great ordeal and its relentless northward crawl. Whatever heights the Isduli afforded, no matter how meager, he would find his gaze wandering across the army of the Middle North, the landslides of trudging men, columns drawing mountainous veils of dust. And if the vision seemed a thing of glory before, it fairly hummed with the gravitas of legend now, clothed as it was with crazed memories of what had been endured, and with dire premonitions of what was to come. For despite the toll the men of the ordeal had exacted, the Horde had not been defeated. It reeled back, diminished, grievously wounded, too quick and too amorphous to be run down. Twice he and Ziranga were called on to deliver missives to the forward pickets, once to Anisarimber Moingus himself. The two of them had galloped ahead with abandon, relieved to be free of the dust and cramp, and wary of the tawny haze that rimmed the horizon before them. Solitary, riding hard across the desolate plain, they felt a peculiar freedom, knowing that Shrenk fenced the north in unseen multitudes. Ziranga told him about a cousin of his, who captained a war galley, how he said he loved and hated nothing more than sailing in the shadow of an ocean tempest. "Only sailors," the successor prince explained, "know where they stand in their god's favor." The schools had been fully mobilized by this time, so as the Horde's dust steamed mountainous above them, they glimpsed sheets of light, not high among the slow swirling veils, but low near the darkening base, flickers of brilliance through funereal shrouds. They would crane their heads, draw their gaze from the high piling summits, floating bright beneath the sun, to the false night of the foundations, and the dread scale would humble and mortify them. Schools, nations, races both foul and illumined. And they understood that even kings and princes counted for nothing when thrown upon the balance with such things. They would ride dumbstruck until the first of the pickets became visible, the companies marked by lighter tassels of dust beneath the sky's spanning mark of the Horde. Finding Moengus, who by this time was notorious for the daring of his exploits, forced them to ride perilously deep until the sun became little more than a pale smear, and the haunting call of the Horde swelled into a deafening roar. "Tell me!" the wild-eyed Prince Imperial cried above the howl, gesturing with his clotted sword to the sunless world around them. "What do infidel eyes see when they look upon my father's foe?"
"Hubris," Ziranga called before Sorwill could restrain him. "Mad misadventure."
"Bah!" Moengus shouted, laughing. "This, my friends! This is where hell concedes earth to heaven. Most men grovel because their fathers groveled, but you, simply for seeing this, you will know why you pray."
And beyond the Prince Imperial, Sorwheel saw them, the nuns, striding above obscurities, racking the earth beneath them, a necklace of shining, warring beads cast thin across the trackless miles, scattering the Shrenk before them. Day in and day out, burning the earth to glass. And then there was the greatest witch of all, Anisarimber Serwa, who had come to seem a miracle of beauty amid the sweat and mannish squalor of the march. She rode a glossy brown, perched with one knee drawn high on a Nilnameshi side saddle, her flaxen hair folded about the perfection of her face, her body slender, almost waifish beneath the simple gowns she wore, were not freighted with her billows. She never spoke to Sorwheel, even though she spent much of her time at her brother's side. She did not so much as look at him, though he could never shake the impression that out of all the shadows that crowded her periphery, she had picked him out for special scrutiny. He was not the only one bewitched by her beauty. He sometimes spent more time watching the others steal glances in her direction than watching her himself. But he did not worship her the way the Zaldunyani did. He did not see her as the daughter of a god. Though he was loath to admit as much, he feared the yearning and at times the raw lust she inspired in him. And so, as is the wont of men, he often found himself resenting, even hating her. The crazed fact was that he needed to hate her. If he were Narindari, a kind of divine executioner chosen by the hundred to deliver the world from the Aspect Emperor, then what struck him as divine in his enemies had to be demonic. Had to be. Otherwise he would be the one dancing from a demon's strings. A Nirindar proper, a servant of a Ajakli, the evil four-horned brother. When he was a child, good and evil had always simplified a world that was unruly and disordered otherwise. Now it vexed him to the point of heartbreak, the treachery of sorting the diabolical and the divine. Some nights he would lie sleepless, trying to will Serwa evil, trying to rub pollution into the image of her beauty. But as always, the memories of her carrying him across the heaving fields of Shrank would rise into his soul's eye, and with it the reeling sense of security and numbing gratitude. And he would think of the murderous intent he concealed behind his mudded cheeks, and of the kore he bore hidden in the ancient pouch bound to his hip, and he would despair. Sometimes, during the more somber meals he and Zaranga shared together, he dared voice his more troubling questions, and the two would set aside their bluster and honestly consider all they had seen. "Gugadarath is not a myth," Soru ventured one night. "The great ordeal marches against a real foe, and that foe is evil. We have seen him with our own eyes." "But what does that mean?" Zaranga replied. "Wickedness is forever warring against wickedness. You should read the annals of my people, Horse King." "Yes, but only when they covet the same things. What could the Aspect Emperor want with these wastes?" "For hatred's sake as well. For hatred's sake." So we wanted to ask what could inspire such hatred, but he conceded the argument, for he already knew what the successor princes would say. His argument of final resort, the one that typically dooms Sorwheel to watches of cringing sleeplessness. "But what about the Hundred? Why would the goddess raise you as a knife?" "Unless the Aspect Emperor were a demon." It made him feel a worm sometimes, a thing soft and blind and helpless. He would raise his face to the sky, and it would seem he could actually feel the great gears of the Dread Mother's design, churning the perpetual dust on the horizon, clacking inscrutable through the voices of innumerable men. He would feel himself carried on the arc of her epic intent, and he would feel a worm. Until he remembered his father.
"Father, father, my bones are your bones."
Sorwheel had always flinched from the thoughts of that final day before Sekarpus fell. For so long, recollecting those events had seemed like fumbling spines of glass with waterlogged fingers. But more and more he found himself returning to his memories, surprised to find all the cutting edges dulled. He wondered at the arrival of the stork in the moments before the Inrithi assault, at the way it had singled out his father. He wondered that his father had sent him away, and so saved his life, almost immediately after. He wondered if the goddess had chosen him even then. But most of all, he pondered their last moment alone together, before they had climbed to man the walls, when they had stood father and son, warming themselves over glowering coals. "There are many fools, Sorwa, men who conceive hearts in simple terms, absolute terms. They are insensible to the war within, so they scoff at it. They puff out their chests and they pretend. When fear and despair overcome them, as they must overcome us all, they have not the wind to think, and so they break." King Harwheel had known, even then. His father had known his city and his son were doomed, and that he had wanted his son, at least, to understand that fear and cowardice were inevitabilities. Caeudas had said it himself. Sense was the plaything of passion. The night of the 10 yoke legions, Zaranga had fled when Sorwheel called, because stopping seemed the height of madness. He simply did what was sensible, and so found himself standing in the long shadow of his friend's bravery. But Sorwheel had stopped on that darkling plain. Against all instinct and reason, he had cast his life across the altar of necessity. "They have not the wind to think." All this time he had mourned his manhood, had made a flag of his humiliation. All this time he had confused his lack of certainty with the lack of strength and honor. But he was strong. He knew that now. Knowing his ignorance simply made his strength that much more canny. And so they break. As ever, the world was a labyrinth, and his was a complicated courage. "Are you such a fool, Sorwa?" "No, father." The men of the ordeal marched, answering to the toll of the interval, day in and day out, until at long last they had chased the arid emptiness to its dregs. Despite its greatness, the Istuli was not inexhaustible. For the first time they awoke to horizons different from those they had greeted the previous morn. The ground was just as gutted by the retreating horde, and the distances were just as devoid of game or any other kind of forage. But the earth bent to a different sensibility. The rolls became deeper. The summits became more pinched. Almost as if the hosts crossed the transitions wrought by age, from the smooth swales of youth to the creases of middle age. Bare rocks scraped clear the turf with ever greater regularity, and the tepid rivers, who had snaked brown and lazy, quickened into white, carving ever deeper ravines. The army of the West, the host commanded by the mercurial king Coithis Sauban, came to the ruins of Suinirsi, a trading entrepot once famed as a link between the high Nosarai of Kuniyiri and the white Nosarai of Exercia. The men of the ordeal were astounded. After so many months of shambling waste, they walked the buried ways of a different, human age, struck by how time makes swamps of scabrous earth. They wondered at the contradiction of ruins, the way some structures are smashed to dust, while others are granted the immortality of geological formations. For the first time, they could connect the tales and rumors that stirred them to take up the circumfix with the stumped earth beneath their feet. And they would stare in their weary, shuffling thousands, the tragedy of lost ages reflected in their eyes. The land had lost its anonymity. Henceforth they knew the earth, for all its desolation, would carry the stamp of long-dead intentions. Where the high Istuli had been barren, a land impervious to the generations who had once ranged across it, its northwestern frontiers were soaked in human history. Ruins teethed the heights, mounded the shallow valleys. The learned told tales of Shinior, the least of the three nations divided between the sons of the first ancient Anisrimber king, Nenor-Ukerja I. Names were debated by firelight, names were invoked by the judges in their sermons, names were called out in curses and in prayers. Everywhere the men of the ordeal looked, they glimpsed ghosts of ancient meaning, the apparitions of ancestors, raising arms, leaning beneath burdens. If they could decode the land, it seemed, see it with ancient eyes, they could reclaim it in the name of men. It passed through them as a shiver, the coincidence of souls antique and new. Though hunger had become a crisis, the numbers who succumbed to sickness declined. The rivers were simply too swift to hold the pollution of the retreating horde, and in some cases they fairly teemed with fish. Nets, borne all the way from Serange and Iran and Kingulet, were cast across the narrows, and the issue was heaved onto the crowded shores. Pike, bass, pickerel, and others. Men ate them raw, such was their hunger. But it was never enough. No matter how much they slowed their progress to throw their nets, they could do no more than prolong the host's starvation. Meanwhile, the horde withdrew and congregated. Day and night the schools assailed the gathering masses, striding into earthbound clouds of gray and ochre, burning and blasting the screeching shadows that fled beneath them. The scarlet spires strode alone through the shrouds with their dragon heads, scourging the wasted earth beneath. The Vokaladi worked with the cunning of wolves, driving swathes of creatures into traps of golden flame. And the Mandadi and the Swayali arrayed themselves in lines miles long, like threads beaded with stars, racking the earth with combs of blinding Gnostic light. The massacre was great, but never great enough. For all their feral simplicity, the Shrank possessed an instinctive cunning. They could hear the schoolmen sing through the world-ringing roar, the unearthly rattle of sorcerous meaning, and so they scattered, ran with speed of fire-maddened horses, scooping up dust both to obscure their foes' vision and to blunt their incandescent dispensations. The culling, the men riding the pickets came to call it. Every evening knights returned with stories of arcane violence glimpsed from afar, and the men of the ordeal wondered and rejoiced. The imperial mathematicians tallied numbers, estimates of slain versus the inexorable accumulation of more and more clans. But they knew only that it was never enough, no matter how devious the tactics or how powerful the sorceries. The horde grew and bloated, an assembly of shrieking mobs that encompassed more and more of the horizon, until all the north screamed. The only tally they knew with certainty was the number of schoolmen lost. The first sorcerer to go missing, a scarlet schoolman named Ursalphus, had been dismissed as a fluke. The prevailing assumption was that the Shrank, even if they had somehow managed to keep Koray through the wide tide of generations, would have no clue as to their purpose. After the fifth schoolman was lost, they realized they were mistaken. Either certain clans had managed to preserve the artifacts, along with some understanding of their use, or, what was more likely, the consult had managed to infiltrate the horde. Perhaps they had scattered contingents of Earthshrank throughout the Shrank host, or perhaps they had simply spread word of the Koray and how they could be used. The possibility occasioned no small amount of debate in the Aspect Emperor's councils. Haramari Iokas, the sightless grandmaster of the Scarlet Spires, argued that the schools should abandon the culling, retire from the field. "Otherwise," he said, "we shall be halved before we reach the gates of Golgotharath." But Nirbanu Soter, the king-regent of High Anon, scoffed, saying the great ordeal would scarce survive to reach the Neliost Sea, let alone Golgotharath, unless the schoolmen continued. "How many battles!" he cried to the blind grandmaster. "How many contests, such as the last, can we endure? 2, 4, 8? For that is the real question." What made the culling so essential, the holy veteran argued, was the degree to which it slowed the horde's cycle of retreat, starvation, and assault. To abandon it altogether would be to invite more skirmishes with disaster. "With each battle we toss the number sticks," the old man said, his voice indomitable, his eyes as dark and cruel as they had been during the first holy war. "Should we risk all for a few dozen wizard skins?" Tempers flared. A rarity in the presence of the Anasarimber, with the schoolmen generally arguing against, and the caste nobility generally arguing for the culling. In the end, the Aspect Emperor declared the culling would continue, but with the schoolmen deployed in tandems to minimize the losses. With their billows, he explained, the odds were good that any one Koray strike could be survived, so long as someone uninjured could carry the one struck away from the horde. "In all things we must conserve and we must sacrifice," he admonished. "We must be acrobats and rope-walkers, both in intellect and in heart. Far worse dilemmas confront us, my brothers. Far more dreadful decisions." And so the horde reeled back, shrank from the pricks of a thousand lights. And the four armies marched into the desolation that was its wake, across lands painted with the horror and glory of the holy sagas, into the gloom of the ancient north. King Nersey Proyas would much rather discuss arms, the dilemmas of the field, and the strategies to overcome them. Instead, his lord and god turned to him and asked, "When you look into yourself, when you look into your soul, how much do you see?"
I see what I see."
The exalt general had spent many sleepless watches on his cot, pondering their discussions while listening to the camp and its dwindling murmur. Recollections from his long years of service and devotion would cycle through his soul's eye, a lifetime of war and ultimatum, and the worrisome sense that something had changed, that these talks were utterly unprecedented both in tenor and content, would grow ever more leaden with dread certainty. As much as he would marvel at the privilege to sit and speak plain truth with a living prophet, he would fear the implications more. Anna Serimba Kellis had waged more than one war, he had come to realize, one far beyond the meager intellects of his followers, one fought across fields of maddening abstraction.
But you do see, I mean, you do possess an inner eye.
I suppose. The Aspect Emperor smiled, rubbed his bearded chin like a carpenter assessing problematic wood. He wore the same plain white gown he always wore, the one Proyas imagined he slept in. The Einani silk was so fine as to be crushed into a thousand wrinkles at his every joint, creases that resembled the forking of twigs in the dim light of the octagonal hearth. Proyas sat frightened, as always, in his imperial armor, his golden cuirass biting his hips, his blue cloak wrapped about his waist in a ceremonial fashion.
"What if some people lack that eye?" Kellis asked. "What if some people could see nothing more than the outline of their passions, let alone the origins of those scribbles? What if most people were blind to themselves? Would they know as much?"
Proyas stared into the luminous gaze of the fire, rubbed his cheeks against the memory of its sorcerous bite. People insensible to their own souls. It seemed he had known many such men over the course of his life, when he considered it. Many such fools.
No, he said meditatively. They would think they see everything there is to be seen.
Kellis smiled in affirmation.
And why is that?
Because they know nothing different, Proyas replied, daring his sovereign's gaze.
You need a glimpse more to know that you see less.
Kellis raised a wooden decanter to refill Proyas's dwindling bowl of ampoy.
Very good, he said as he poured.
So you understand the difference between you and me?
I do.
Where you were blind, his lord and god said, I can see. Proyas paused in hesitation, drank deep from his bowl, the tang of nectar, the bite of liquor. At a time when clear water had become a luxury, sipping ampoy seemed an almost obscene extravagance. But then everything had the taste of miracles in this room.
And this is why a Kamian speaks true?
Simply asking the question loosed a queasiness in his gut. As much as the topic of his old tutor and his heresy troubled Proyas, the fact that Kellis knew the unruly thoughts the man occasioned disturbed him even more. Proyas had not so much buried Drusus Akamian as turned his back on him, the way men are wont to do with matters too acidic to honestly consider. He had grown into manhood in the sorcerer's critical shadow, clinging to his convictions in a fog of nagging questions. He could not think of him without suffering some flutter of spiritual insecurity, without hearing his warm and amiable voice saying, "Yes, Prosha, but how do you know?" And now, 20 years after Akamian's famed denunciation and subsequent exile, Kellis had inexplicably raised the specter of the man and his questions.
Why?